on this edition of The Self-Publishing Show.
I'm 51 now. 10% of the books I read, I don't finish these days because I get three or four chapters in and I think that structure isn't there, or it's being self-indulgent or whatever. And I think I'm not going to read all the books I want to read before I die. So I put it down and I'll start something else.
Publishing is changing. No more gatekeepers, no more barriers, no one standing between you and your readers. Do you want to make a living from your writing? Join indie bestseller Mark Dawson and first-time author James Blatch as they shine a light on the secrets of self-publishing success. This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Hello and welcome. It's The Self-Publishing Show with James Blatch.
And Mark Dawson.
Resplendent in your book, Bub T-shirt, and your... I don't know if people can see your bare legs, because I can't see the shot that people can see.
You can't. You can see my bare legs, but no one else can. This is kind of the newsreader shot.
It's... I love talking about the weather. I don't care if people criticise me. I'm British, and I will talk about the bloody weather. It is 33 degrees, which in American money is 90-something today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty hot here as well.
I'm wearing my Nashville T-shirt. I'm assuming it's a T-shirt that keeps you cool. I mean, I certainly look cool in it, that's for sure.
Debatable, yes.
Long pause. In honour of our friend Dave Chesson and everybody else who lives in Nashville. Who else lives in Nashville? I think that, yes, I probably shouldn't say, because I think somebody's daughter lives in Nashville and a few other people, and it's a fun place to be. Little book crowd there. We are ploughing on through the summer months and ploughing on still through COVID, which is refusing to go away. In Europe, there's talk about a second wave. In America, they still seem to be cresting the first wave. So all the things we've talked about over previous weeks about market changes are all still relevant. And we would say to people, I guess, Mark, stay vigilant, keep an eye on the figures and react.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I'm actually looking at buying stock in Amazon at the moment because they put their figures out. So all the tech companies put their figures out yesterday, didn't they? And they were all... they're all very strong figures. I think Amazon had 40% bigger revenue for this quarter just gone as the comparative quarter last year. Amazon stock is probably, obviously I'm not an advisor. I'm certainly not qualified to tell anyone about anything about buying stock, but it's certainly one that's I think might be quite interesting.
I do tiny bits of dabbling in stock and I'm terrible at it. Really, I'm always... I think the only way to buy stock, if you're someone like me, is to invest a couple of hundred quid and then forget about it for 5 years. And over five years, you should, unless the company goes bust. But I bought Tesla Slack, which we use as a productivity tool. And I thought that would go up because homeworking and so on. Something called Workhorse that a mate told me to buy. And IAG, who own British Airways now, which sounds like an unusual one, but they really bottomed out. And I thought, in the long run, they are going to be one of the survivors. And so I think it's a long-term thing. But I've lost money on all of them. Even Slack and Tesla.
Oh, Tesla's a funny one, isn't it? It's
Apple all-time high yesterday, weren't they? As you say, the stocks, the digital stocks coming out. And I suppose the pure indie companies, I mean, you're wearing your BookBub T-shirt. There's a few other pure indie companies are at this stage. I don't think any of them are publicly listed. They're all sort of privately owned organizations, but in the long run will be bought by PLCs or will become PLCs. It'd be interesting in a few years' time that we can invest in the properly invest, because at the moment it's a select band of people get invited to either start a company themselves or invest in somebody else's. But it would be nice to buy some shares in BookBub or, you know, one of the big sort of indie organizations, maybe even SBF PLC.
Yes. Yeah, we'll see about that. No, it's BookBub do listen to the podcast. I know, we know that, don't we? So you never know, we might get an email next week with
inviting us to invest.
Options.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, if I invest, it might be the kiss of death. You should invest.
Yeah, send it to me, not to you.
Not to me. Okay, look, let us welcome some Patreon supporters. The shout-outs for this week go to Monique Elton and Travis Zenzaki and Dad FC. Dad FC. Dad,
I think that's the book. I don't remember the author's name, but I've seen in the SPF community today or yesterday a cover with Dad FC, and I think that may be it. And I thought the cover was quite good. So yes, good luck with that one.
So in the UK, that would be Football Club, Dad Football Club, as in AFL or whatever. What do you put? What are the letters after the name of The Miami Dolphins. AFL, is it?
No, NFL.
NFL,
isn't it?
Yeah.
But that's the league. It's not the, it doesn't no. It doesn't mean the club.
But we have
I don't think they have an AFC equivalent. No.
Association Football Club. Some clubs are still AFC, aren't they? AFC Wimbledon, Association Football Club Wimbledon.
Bournemouth AFC, yeah.
Bournemouth AFC. Poor Bournemouth, they went down, didn't they? Poor Bournemouth. Right, enough chitter-chatter. We have Ian Sainsbury on this week. I have to be careful because I have called him Ian Salisbury almost his whole life. And it's funny, he said to me, everyone calls him Ian Salisbury. He's not really sure why, but he is.
Do you know, that's in my head as well. Yeah. It's funny. Weird, isn't it?
It is weird. Weird one. But he is Ian Sainsbury, as in the supermarket chain here in the UK. But as far as he can tell, and he's done some digging, he's not related because they're a minted family. But Ian Sainsbury, we first came across Ian, well, you first came across him when you were the judge on the Kindle Storyteller Awards here in the UK 3 years ago, I want to say, two or three years ago.
Last year.
Ian was last year. I thought our friend from Sydney was last year. Anyway, she may have been the year before. Okay, so Ian was last year, and lo and behold, he only went and won, Ian, didn't he? With a good book.
Very good book, yes, he did. I think four or five books came to us as the judges to read, and there were some really good books, actually, a good selection, and Ian's, I felt, was a particularly good one, and very pleased to see him, the awards night, or the night that the prize was awarded. I was watching, because obviously I knew he was about to get his name called, and I was watching him and his wife as Mariella Fostrup, who's the kind of the celebrity judge that year, called his name out, and it was really lovely, really lovely. He was bowled over, I think, and his wife burst into tears. It was just lovely moments, and he's a really nice guy, so
yeah,
I was very happy for him, and it's completely deserving, really good book.
Yeah.
Called the Picture on the Fridge.
Yes, very good book. Now, what's worth talking about, and the reason we've had Ian on, not just because of that success, the fact he's a good writer, is understanding how to make money, you know, how to commercialise your writing if that's what you want to do, because simply writing a lovely book might not be enough. We know that there are some strategies in terms of series, and also the type of genre fiction that sells in large numbers might be higher selling than literary fiction, and so on. So all these things factor in. And Ian is somebody who's been very thoughtful about this, wants to write what he wants to write what he loves reading, but at the same time wants a better commercial career out of it. So he's put some thought into this. And without preempting the interview too much, he came up with a very interesting strategy, didn't he, going for genre fiction and then breaking it down, almost designing it around, I think, the Kindle Unlimited model.
Yeah, shorter fiction. So he followed the Dean Koontz Nameless series model. So this was Dean Koontz, published with Thomas and Mercer, maybe six short 20,000-word novellas that were all with the same character, very nicely stylized. The covers look great. They're all very colorful. They look the same. And that, obviously, I had the Amazon marketing machine behind it, but those books appeared to clean up. They were very highly ranked for a long time, and they're still highly ranked today. So I think Ian looked at that, and to be honest, I've looked at that too. I think there is that kind of more serialized, shorter reads. There is no reason why that shouldn't be effective, but it's apart from a kind of in the early days that did work a little bit. And I'm thinking of people like Sean Platt and Dave Wright with their Yesterday's Gone series, although that wasn't quite the same, but in a similar kind of fashion. It hasn't really taken off since then, and I don't know why that is. I find that quite a curious one. But anyway, Ian is having a crack at that himself with his Bedlam Boy series, which I've read and enjoyed, and I hope that it works for him.
Yeah, okay, let's hear from Ian.
This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Well, I like your background as the background of an artist.
Well, that's true. You can't see the piano. That's on that side.
I can see the piano.
No, that's the keyboard.
Oh, that's the keyboard. Sorry.
So that's Arturia master keyboard for linking up to iPad stuff and the iMac for Logic. And then the piano, acoustic piano, is over here.
Okay. Right. Wow.
There's instruments everywhere. There's a cajon.
A what?
Cajon, yeah, sort of Spanish drum you sit on.
Okay.
That's not a box there. That's a
car. Yes. I've seen someone playing that. I remember there was a Dido video of someone sitting on playing that, and I wondered if it was just a box he was sitting on playing, but now I know it's a cajon. There you go.
Yeah, another lovely little instrument that is.
Sounds almost like the instrument I could probably play, one you just sit on and tap.
Well, this is the great thing about it. If you can't play it, what you've got is a slightly expensive stool.
Yes. Well, look, here we are. I think we can start the interview with us waffling at the beginning. It's an intriguing beginning to Ian Sainsbury, who I keep wanting to call Salisbury. We've just explained that I'm not the only one who does that, because Sainsbury is a very famous supermarket brand in the UK. And for whatever reason, it confuses our minds. But you are Ian Sainsbury, not related to the supermarket.
No, not at all, unfortunately.
But you are an author, and you're an author who was recognised and picked up. Last year, was it that you won the Kindle... remind me of the name of the competition. It's the Kindle Storyteller Award. And I think where they are open for submissions as we speak, I think up until August. I should probably have looked all this up before we got going. But if you...
Yeah, look, me too.
Yeah, if you Google Kindle Storyteller Award. Now, this is... an award that the likes of LJ Ross, Mark Dawson, I think Claudia Winkleman, is that right, this year, are, I think Marietta Frostrop in the past has been a judge, so they're quite famous people in the UK. So it's a literary award. It's an award we love because it's geared around people who upload their books to Amazon, generally independent publishers. And there's a gala night, and you went along. Did you have any idea that you might win?
I know everyone says no, but it genuinely was no. And I can almost sort of prove it, because on the train on the way down, I was with my wife, Ruth, and I was so convinced that I wouldn't win that I said, look, if I do, there's this ridiculous piece of musical equipment that I've always fancied owning, which is a little keyboard called the OP1. It's massively overpriced, beautiful piece of equipment. And I'd always fancied having one. I said, I'll tell you what, if I win, I'll get one of those. And she went, yeah, good idea. And I thought, right, okay, now.
Because she was safe in the knowledge. She obviously thought she wouldn't win either.
She knew it wasn't happening, because I'd already explained, you know, that it wasn't going to happen, but we were going to have a nice night out and a few drinks, Swish Hotel, you know. And there's a great photo from the night, if you think I'm kidding, where it's got my wife, when just after she burst into tears, and my face, which is, it's an unfakeable expression, where the jaw shock has dropped open.
well, that's delightful that you got through. So you this is a competition that you do have to enter. So you have to submit for it. So you obviously thought you were in the ring, and at some point you get a notification you've been shortlisted, which must have been your first shock.
Yeah. It's such an easy competition to enter. They make it easy for you, because you just replace one of your keywords on the upload page with Kindle Storyteller 2019 or 2020 this year. But it's one of those things, I suppose it's even less effort than buying a lottery ticket, which I don't do, but you just think, well, I might as well. It's just using one of my keywords and someone's got to win it, right? You know, and then you forget all about it because it's months later. And it must have been early September, I think, when I got an email from Darren Hardy, who heads up Kindle UK. Well, you know Darren.
Yes.
Well,
we know Darren.
He's been on the show. Lovely guy. And I thought, it must be the shortlist, because there's no other reason why he would want to talk to me. Why on earth would he want to talk to me? So I did think that must be it. And he called me when I was driving, and I pulled over, and he said, yeah, you're on the shortlist. You can't talk about it for a week until we get the press release out. And I didn't know who else was on it. And that's at the point when I looked for the first time at the Storyteller page and saw how many pages it was of entries and how many thousands, and thought, oh, this is ridiculous. But he also had some featured entries. And I looked at all of them and I thought, well, they all look great. And one of them, I'd read three of his books already.
Right.
Queeve McDonald, great comic thriller. So that was when I relaxed at that point, because I thought, well, I love his stuff. He's great. So I expect he'll win. And I just started practicing my game face, you know.
Yeah. You're brave.
Yeah, slightly well done. Disappointed, but yes. Yeah, got to acknowledge that it's a terrific book.
But then he sat there, and on the night, it was a memorable night actually for us, because I think we saw Jamie Lee Curtis in the bar when I went down to interview Louise before she and Mark hobnobbed it off to the awards. I went then home dressed in my jeans and T-shirt, but in the bar of the hotel was Jamie Lee Curtis and Christopher Guest. Actually, I'm not sure if Christopher Guest was there. Anyway, that's my memory from the night. Your memory from the night is sitting there and hearing your name read out and then being shocked. So,
yeah, Jamie Lee Curtis and Christopher Guest would have done... That would have been the icing on the cake.
Yeah.
I'm a huge Spinal Tap fan. So.
Oh, there you go. There you go. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about your writing, Ian. And this is obviously a fantastic achievement for you to be recognised like this. And that, like, as you say... Lots and lots of entries. I have no idea how they even begin the process of whittling it down, but I know it's taken very seriously. And I know that the judges have a lot of discussion and deliberation about this, and a lot of thought goes into this. So this was not, you know, this was not a lottery. There was not a drawing of a name out of a hat. This was a meritorious award for you. So well done on that. So when did writing start for you? And at what point has it become your main focus?
I think like most writers, when I was young, it was always an option in my head somewhere because I love reading so much. And when you're an obsessive reader, like I was, I think there's always part of you that thinks, I wonder if I could do this, because you know, it's just, what a way to earn a living, you know. But music was always my biggest strength, where my mind anyway. My dad's a musician. My grandfather was a drummer, ran a band in Bristol. So I ended up going into music, which is what I always wanted to do. And the writing, I suppose it became part of that, really. I wrote music and I wrote songs, and then worked as a musician for decades, and ended up doing stand-up comedy for a few years as well. Wow. So that's where the writing came back, I suppose, because I had to sit down and write a set. You know, so I wrote jokes and sort of short comedy songs. I used to walk on stage with a keyboard around my neck, which wasn't one of those keyboards like a keytar. It was a light one. This was a proper heavy
right.
keyboard that I had holes drilled into. So killed my shoulder. It's a good job comedy sets are only 20 minutes long. But I suppose that's when the writing came back again. And I think that gave me confidence, because that went pretty well. And I also wrote material for other people. I suppose the most famous of which is Paul Zerdin, who won America's Got Talent season 10. He's an old friend of mine. I co-wrote his show and all the music for it. And it's actually when he was in Vegas, that was his prize, was a Vegas show, you know,
wow.
the following year. So he was out doing that. And I was there for the first 6 weeks, and that was when I'd finally written my first novel the year before, and put it out just about 3 or 4 weeks before we went to Vegas. So it was just then, when I was out there, that I started to see the dashboard for the first time and started to see sales coming in. And it actually did, the first book did pretty well quite quickly. So while I was out there, I thought, well, I better write another one. I'd written the first as a standalone, but I'd left it a bit open. So I started writing the second one. Just everything went really well, quickly enough for me to think, well, I'll give the music a break for a while.
Yeah.
And I'm still on the break.
Yeah. And the stand-up break as well?
Yeah, well, the stand-up I did for about 3.5 years. That was back 2003-ish, I think. And I really enjoyed it, but I was doing about 40,000 miles a year.
Wow.
And young, well, at that time, just one kid, but very young, and I didn't enjoy that side of it so much.
Aye.
So I decided I'd carry on writing bits and pieces, but I wouldn't go out and gig anymore. So I did the occasional thing.
Right.
But the last one was about 3 or 4 years ago, but no, it's the keyboard's been sold.
Oh, the with the holes in it.
I say that, yeah, that one's gone. There's still another five in the house. Yeah. So it's, you know, it could still happen. But
and of course, another one since you won the Kindle Storyteller Award.
Yes, yeah.
So the first novel, what was it? And How did you decide what it was you were going to write?
The first one's called The World Walker, and that's a sci-fi novel. And I think I decided on that because probably my absolute love for reading was in my teens, like most people. That's when I was really reading loads. And at that point, I was reading loads of Ray Bradbury and Ursula Le Guin and Robert Heinlein and Asimov. And, so it was a lot of science fiction, which I've always kept reading science fiction, but not as avidly as I did then. But I think it's just when I sat down to write, the ideas I'd start to jot down, a lot of them were very on the speculative side and on the sci-fi side. And it just gave me a real, I suppose, the broadest possible canvas at that point. I had so many ideas, James.
Yeah,
it's ridiculous. Right. So many ideas. I've always said my ideal job would be someone paid me just to sit down and have ideas, which kind of is what writing is. So I think I probably had 25, 30 ideas written down, just basic ones that I could have expanded into a novel. And then I heard an interview with James Burke, if you remember him from the...
Yes, the TV presenter, scientist guy.
That's it, yeah. He did an interview in the 80s, early 80s, I think, on Radio 4, where they asked him to predict things over the next 30 years. And he got a lot of it right, including social media. He said people would be willing to give up their privacy,
yeah,
and give information willingly, you know, and which must have sounded pretty weird at the time, but
yeah,
he was right.
And now we do it every day of the week, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And they asked him back on, and I heard that interview, and so that must have been 2015, I should imagine, and said, what about the next 30 years? And his big thing was nanotechnology.
Right.
And he said, because we could end up in a society of abundance rather than shortage, you know, where everybody's got more than enough, which is a lovely idea, because you could make anything you need out of these easily available elements, and with nanotechnology, anybody could live anywhere, they could eat anything. So my cynical side said, that sounds amazing, but what if that technology was already here and some people knew about it, they wouldn't be sharing it. And that was the spark.
Okay.
That started the book.
Is that also the that led to theories of the grey glue, grey goo? That was it. Have you ever heard that?
The grey goo.
So I think, I'm surprised you don't know, I think if I've got this right, that when people first started talking about nanotechnology, these tiny little machines that were, you know, initially, I think we're not that far away from them being able to clean windows and things, but if they got a reproductive element to them, which they'd probably need to sustain themselves, there would be an inevitable point where they would take over the planet and just cover us in a meter of grey goo, because we wouldn't be able to stop them reproducing and we'd all die. That was one of the theories. But anyway, I think Prince Charles once latched onto that. We should also say about James Burke, if people want to know who James Burke is, they need to look on the internet and Google James Burke rocket piece to camera, because it was the greatest television piece to camera in the history of television. It's an absolutely incredible, he's an amazing TV presenter. But if you look up, we'll get Alexandra to put it in the show notes, because it's always worth a watch. You want to see how television was done properly back in the 70s. Okay, so James Burke, very inspirational guy, actually, to me as well, the more I think about him. And you had these ideas going around. So you wrote your sci-fi book. Looks great, actually. Cover looks intriguing. A fantastic blurb. And in those days, so remind me what year this was you uploaded this?
End of March 2016.
End of March 2016. You uploaded it. Did you do anything else? Or first of all, did you think about getting an agent or querying a contract? No.
I had a friend called Murray McDonald, and he wrote thrillers. So he's Scottish. He was living in Norfolk, and he wrote American political thrillers, obviously. And he'd had quite a bit of success, and they were all standalones, and I knew absolutely nothing about this, but he encouraged me when I said, you know, I'd always fancied writing a book, which I'm sure, well, I know pretty much everybody says. Yeah. He encouraged me, and I imagine he encouraged me in the way I encourage people when they say that, which is just genuine, but you think, well, I'll never hear from them again.
Yeah.
But I did do it, and he could see I was saying, oh, got, you know, I've got 40,000 words or whatever. And he started to take more of an interest. And it was him who, because I think I'd seen, he talked to me about his experience. It didn't even cross my mind to go to find an agent or go to a publisher. And I'm not quite sure why. It was nothing about, I didn't think one was better than the other. I just thought, this is, I can write this and I can put it out there. And maybe, I mean, I was optimistic and ambitious. I thought, yeah, a few hundred people might read it. And in which case there might be a few of those who really like it. And that would be good. And there was a part of me that thought, actually, as I was writing it, I thought, this is better than I'd hoped. You know, it was,
okay.
It was good. The writing was, I mean, I can't bring myself to read it now. And that's, I don't want to put anyone off it. It's not that at all. It's, I don't reread anything. Mm. I feel like this is a new way of building a career in a way. So that first book is always going to be my first book. It's absolutely bursting with ideas and enthusiasm and excitement. And there are some passages in it I'm proud of, but it's, you know, it's just, whoa, here's everything I'm thinking. And it's, but it really grabbed people. I think it was that excitement and enthusiasm in the writing that got people to enthuse about it. And, you know, word of mouth did its trick somehow.
It's got 739 reviews on Amazon.co.uk at 4.6 out of 5 average, which is outstanding. So obviously it is a loved book. And in terms of your sort of experience, you obviously had no experience of writing a novel. So how did you approach the structure? And I mean, you obviously read a lot. So is that basically where this came from?
Yeah, I think all of us who read an awful lot, which I did. I mean, when I was working in piano bars in Norway, before the Kindle came out, I used to take 5-6 books with me from charity shops, thrift stores, you know, say in America, and that they used to go with me on the plane. And I used to leave them. When I finished reading them, I'd tuck them in the back of the plane, a seat in front or in a restaurant in Norway or in a hotel room so that other people could pick them up. But this was an expensive hobby of mine. But so I think structure just seeps into you when it's done well and when it's done badly. And of course, I'm interested in writing and creating, always have been. So, and if you write songs, structure is extremely important. It's not only knowing why you need structure and how it works, it's knowing when you can safely deviate from it in an interesting way.
Yeah.
And trust the reader to go with you or the listener. I mean, all the greatest songs, or most, have got that element of familiarity and something that's slightly different in there, and which you might, the first time you listen, you will notice it. But a really good example is Yesterday by the Beatles. Mm-hmm. That's a 7-bar phrase, that song. Now, 98% of pop songs go in 8-bar phrases. You know, if you've heard the expression middle 8, that's because it's an 8-bar phrase in the middle of a song. So the 7-bar phrase is quite unusual, but we don't hear it anymore. And you don't listen to Yesterday and think, but there's anything missing at the end of the phrase, because it's gone past that stage where you think, oh, there's something a bit different about it. And it's become a classic in its own right. So it's, I think, in the same way that you listen to lots of music and you adapt the structure, you do the same as it become from a reader to a writer.
Yeah. So it was innate with you. You'd read so much.
I was going to say that's the starting point, but then you have to be constantly checking your own structure and knocking it and thinking, is that actually working? And that's after the first draft, going back and reading through and thinking, well, hang on, actually being able to put the editing head on and think, I can lose 3,000 words here, or that chapter, just, you know, why is it there?
Yeah.
And being able to do that. I'd say that's, I'm 51 now. I probably 10% of the books I read, I don't finish these days, because I get 3 or 4 chapters in and I think that structure isn't there, or it's being self-indulgent or whatever. And I think, I'm not going to read all the books I want to read before I die. So I put it down and I'll start something else.
And your book garnered reviews and readers. And in terms of sales?
Yeah, it did. I mean, like I say, I knew nothing, so I had nothing to compare it to. I was on no forums. I did everything backwards. I think towards the end of my first series, I started to realize there was a community out there. So I didn't know what was good, what was bad, what was expected, what wasn't, what I should be working on. And sales, I think the second month it was out, I remember it made me 2,000 quid.
Wow.
The first book. And of course, yeah. And knowing now what I know, if someone said that to me, I'd go, whoa, you know, you better get right in the next one. They'll plan a series, get on with it.
Yeah.
But at the time I thought, oh, that's good, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
that's nice. Blimey. I just thought, well, that'll tail off. But it'd be nice to write another one. And I remember thinking if I could write 3 books a year and they could make me $6,000 a piece, then you know, it wouldn't be a living, but it'd be worth doing. I'd be able to justify the time I spent writing them financially. I wouldn't feel like I was robbing my children of their inheritance by indulging something that I loved doing. But yeah, they did a lot better than that. And as the second book and the third book came out, I think when the fourth one was on pre-order, that was when it was really doing well. And I was having 5-figure months at that point.
Without doing much marketing, or?
I hear the disbelief in your voice, James. Yeah. And again, knowing what I know now, I can only echo that. But I did, the first book went up, and I did what no one should do, which is you tell your friends and family, who of course are going to buy it, but they, you know, all they're also bought is gardening and or whatever else. It's not going to help you. But somehow the word spread, and I suppose this is to do with, it must have sold a certain amount in the first few hours, and maybe Amazon just put it in front of a few sci-fi readers. And I think it had a lot of tropes in there that people were happy to see, but it also completely upended a lot of them. And they were really pleased to have that original take on some old tropes. So I think it was good old word of mouth and Amazon algorithm catching that somehow.
Yeah.
I haven't been able to reproduce it in quite that same way.
Okay.
But now, like I say, it's all backwards. But
and this
now
is this is science fiction, which a lot of people do say is a more difficult genre to sell. And they look enviously across at the romance and thriller writers. But you obviously hit something with this series. You went on, I can see there's 4 books in the series.
Mm-hmm.
The World Walker series. So you finished that in 2017. And by the end, by book 4, what sort of state were you in terms of the finances? Did this now look like it was a full-time job for you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think by the time I was writing book 3, I thought, yeah, I should be putting my energies into this. So I think, yeah, it was about a year to a year and a half after I released the first one, that in my head I'd transferred. I mean, it's a bit different to most people because I hear people on the podcast and people on forums saying, you know, they did the various jobs that they've had, but they kept going, well, they've been writing on their commute or whatever. Mm. But I was a professional musician, or layabout as we're known. So it's a very different lifestyle. I've always been self-employed. I've dabbled with employment, but it's not been a good fit for me, really. So I already had that freelance mentality, I suppose. So it wasn't as massive a shift. It was just something mentally where I thought, okay, this is my... It still took me probably another year before when people asked me what I did.
You said writer, yeah.
Yeah, I said writer rather than musician.
Yeah.
I still feel like a musician who writes.
Fair enough. So you got to the end of that series and you decided, I think it was the point at which you decided to change genre.
Well, there was a slight shift at the end of that series. I wrote a superhero trilogy. So that's, but from a sort of science fiction point of view, in a way, that was the half hero trilogy. Superhero, but with explanations. So there's some kind of science behind it. I'm not big into 3 pages of explaining genetic backgrounds to, you know, why this is going on or whatever. I'm much more about the characters and the story and the twists and turns. But there was a bit more of a science fiction take on superheroes. And also, apart from Alan Moore, who's the great writer of things like Watchmen and V for Vendetta and From Hell, there wasn't much in the way of superheroes in Britain.
So this is a British superhero?
Yeah, it is. And a kind of alternate timeline idea as well.
So okay. It's time the world was saved by a British superhero, I feel.
Yeah, well, we've got Doctor Who.
Yes.
So I'm surprised. I can think of a few points in the last few years where he could have gone back and just fixed things. Well, I've got a list for him.
I think we all have. May,
you know, yeah.
Definitely start with, we're starting 2020 again. How did the sales go with that? How did that compare with the first series?
They never sold as well, but part of that, I think, was most people thought I was American with World Walker, because that was another decision I made early on, was, again, with a friend of mine who was writing these political thrillers. His were all written in American English, and no one guessed he was Scottish living in Norfolk. So I thought, yeah, good idea. So mine was set in, I mean, I've worked in America and travelled there a little bit, and there's Google, of course. So I set it in America, used American spellings, and that gave me access to a bigger market straight away. I had someone on Facebook ask me if it's a cynical money-making ploy to write in American English, and I answered, well, I'll take out the word cynical.
Yeah.
but if there's,
it's a loaded question, isn't it? Is that advert just a cynical attempt to sell this lawnmower?
Exactly. I was trying to sell more copies. Yes. Okay. I'm holding my hand up. Yeah.
Guilty.
That was something I was aiming to do, rather than fewer copies and retain my integrity
for being British.
Setting it in Britain and writing in British English again, I think my writing got better. But then again, the more you write, the better you get, hopefully. But I think it limited sales, certainly to the American audience. Maybe I was asking a bit much. I don't want to generalize, really, because I've got plenty of American readers who love that series. But maybe they were less willing to take that chance from scratch. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it did. I mean, that one did really well on Audible, particularly, actually, strangely enough. They ran a promotion on that, got to number one for a couple of days in the UK, the first in that series. It's a well-loved series. And again, it's a really satisfying series. I'm really pleased with the way that one turned out. I limited my market, I think, by setting a science fiction superhero book in Britain. But there you go. You know, you at the time, I was still trying things, and just the next 30 ideas, looking in the notebook and go, oh, this is going to be fun. I'm going to write this. So that was, and that carried on. After that, I wrote a standalone dark fantasy book.
Right.
With my career progression. Yeah. You know, carefully mapped out.
Yeah.
What's next? Okay, so you've had a massively successful series that you wrote in American English, set in America, with aliens and nanotechnology, then a less successful book. I was very happy with it. Series set in Britain, superhero, which has done really well in this country. So what you really need to write next, obviously, is a standalone dark fantasy, but where the only book you could compare it to, I think, is probably Clive Barker's Weave World.
Right.
Which he didn't write another one like that afterwards. So
it's clearly the book
you should have told me.
Yeah, your readers were expecting you to write. So
yeah.
And that was a standalone. And when did the book that won the Kindle Storyteller Award, when did that hove
into
view?
That was the next one. And again, if you want to see where my thinking was going then, I think at that point I finally thought, well, okay, I've written lots of words now. I've written 8 books and I know how to structure a story. And I'm very, my reading is extremely broad, and I've read quite a lot of psychological thrillers, and I enjoy the format. And I had one of those 30 ideas was one that just kept coming back to me and nagging at me. And I thought, okay, I know this is a stupid idea to write another standalone. What I should be doing is writing a science fiction series now. And I had a 9-book series in my head, and I started to make notes on that and starting to do things sensibly. But this bloody idea, I just couldn't get it out of my head. And I thought, right, okay. So standalone, it'll take me a couple of months to write a draft of it. I'll see how it looks, knock it into shape. Try and make it. I mean, I always feel like writing, I know I'm not the first to say this, is you get this wonderful idea and it looks perfect, and then you just systematically destroy it. Mm. But I ended up with something that still looked vaguely like that lovely idea at the end. And then a couple of drafts later, I thought, yeah, this is actually, it really works well, but it's a thriller. It's a massive market compared to sci-fi.
Is this the picture on the fridge?
Yeah. Yeah. So that was, and I like the title as well. That was the other thing. The title was there from the beginning. Yes.
Yeah. The title's great. And you've got a tagline on the cover as well. So this was a one-off. Well, I guess it has to be. Those psychological thrillers that usually end in that have a death and a conclusion tend to be standalone, except of course you could use the detective or something or a character again.
Yeah. I mean, I had this one actually, I did send out to a couple of agents, and I had some correspondence with a couple as well, and one of them said, is there any way you can make this into a series? You know, I really like it. Is there anything you can do? Is there a character you can bring through? And there's a journalist in the picture on the fridge called Patrice Martino, an Italian American, and he's a fun character. He's definitely got a life of his own. So that was the possibility, but it would have been a very tentative link, really. Mm. Although he's been in my mind recently with the series I'm writing now, so okay. There's a possibility that he might actually resurface. But no, I felt like it had to be a standalone, that one. It's just I knew how it was going to end, and I didn't think there was really any
no
coming back from that.
But it won you the award, which, you know, was I'm sure an enormous fillip to you in terms of believing that your writing is good, and obviously you had evidence from sales as well. And then after that, I know you have been thinking commercially. I mean, cynically, Ian, you've been thinking.
I know. Crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, cynically, you've been thinking about selling books rather than just writing them for your own pleasure and sitting there. And your conclusion, I think, was to go down the thriller route.
Yeah, well, I'm a massive Lee Child fan. I know Mark is, I believe he may have targeted some of his advertising.
Possibly. The Lee Child. Some similarities. I don't
know. Yeah. And I love those books. And it's really, I think I've sort of fell in love with those books since becoming a writer. I wasn't reading them before. And I just picked one up and then read all of them. I thought they were so well done. And then with my professional writer's head on, I was thinking, if you've got a character that can go from book to book to book, that readers fall in love with, then you're onto a winner, aren't you? And Lee Child with his one book every year.
Mm. September the 1st, he sits down.
Yeah, although that would drive me nuts. Only to do one a year, you know.
Yeah.
but there you go. And of course, Mark with John Milton. So if you can find that character that can go on through books without starting to look like it's wearing thin, and readers always, you know, if you read sometimes book 19, 20 of a series, you look at the reviews and of various long-running thrillers, and you'll start to see doubts creeping in from readers saying, "Well, I'm just wondering now," you know.
Yeah.
If we're just retreading old ground. But there are some characters that seem to be able to just sustain that forever.
And there's something to be said for, I mean, we talk a lot in our house about James Bond for some reason. My boy's really into the films. So we talk a lot about the familiarity. Oh God, I can't speak today. It's Monday morning. Putting on a pair of socks, basically, a comfortable pair of slippers that are comfortable, which is what a James Bond film has been, even up until now. And even now, with all the time and money, they know it's a big you know, it's going to make money. It's very rare you have a film franchise where you're basically guaranteed that it's going to make money. And even with that, they still tread out basically the same evil baddie who's going to take over the world, and Bond gets caught and prisoned and brought to the point of death and then saves the day. And I'm thinking, do something different. Do something different. You know, have a three-film series where it's young Bond before he joined the Secret Service, or he's retired and he's got some daughter who turned up from the middle. They know what they're doing, right? So we go on about we've got to do it differently, but actually the message we get from readers and film viewers in this case is they want the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a reason why you keep seeing sequels.
Yeah.
In Hollywood, and critics moan about it, and audiences moan about it, but they go.
Yeah. Familiarity is a key factor, I think. It's actually a psychological factor in why we buy certain brands in the supermarket as well, isn't it? It's the same, probably the same psychology, that knowing what you're going to get. We all get that sometimes. You go through Netflix, whatever, work out what film you're going to watch, and you often make a safe choice. If you see key indicators of something you've seen before, like Will Ferrell comedy or something like that, that's why people are able to open films and make money. It's a whole psychology around this. So is that we've talked about this a lot on the podcast, about it's a mistake quite often to try to be different. Commercially is a mistake.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of put your finger on the tension there of doing what we do, I think, because there's the creative side, the artistic temperament, not temperament exactly, but the artistic imperative, you know, it drives you, is saying, I want to create something, I want to do something exciting, I want to do something that makes me excited. But then you also want to make a living, and satisfy readers. So in fact, the Blurred Lands, so my dark fantasy, it's a great example. That's probably some of my best writing is in that book. And sold fewer than any other book I wrote, but it's the best reviewed by all 12 of the people who read it.
You've got 132 reviews on .co.uk, so
yeah,
least 132 people read it.
Yeah, no, it did okay. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but it did fine.
Yeah,
but it's almost like I limited the market before even getting it out there. I think if more people sort of came through the door and gave it a go, then they'd be pleasantly surprised. But it very much is dark fantasy. There are monsters. There are suggestions of the supernatural, more than suggestions. You know, there are gods. There are all sorts of things in there. The kitchen sink makes a brief appearance.
Yes.
In a spooky aside. But it's also about grief, you know. So it's actually it's a book I'm proud of. But commercially, my commercial head had taken a little holiday at that point and came back and went, "What have you done?"
Yeah. there's a lack of cynicism in writing this. But one choice, I guess, was open to you. I mean, that conversation you had with the agent about finding a recurring character for the psychological thriller. But one option for you is just to write a series of standalone, quite similar psychological thrillers. You don't necessarily need there to be the same character for that to become a series, the difference between series and serials in there. But, you know, to market them together, that must have been an option for you.
Yeah, there's if you look at someone like Mark Edwards, I think it's with Thomas and Mercer, and that's what he does. They're all standalone, but they're all psychological thrillers, and they're very recognisable in their style. That familiarity is there with his stuff, definitely. You know, you know what you're getting into.
So did you think about that?
Yeah, I did. And I have a few psychological thriller ideas. I don't think I could sustain writing three or four psychological thrillers a year. I think I would get bored, and that boredom would come through in my writing. The thing with The Picture on the Fridge was, it was such a good idea that it wouldn't let go of me. And I do have one other psychological thriller idea, but similarly keeps coming back. So I imagine at some point,
you're right,
another standalone psychological thriller. But the sort of creative and commercial side, to try and satisfy both of them, that's the holy grail. So that idea of having a Jack Reacher or a John Milton, you know, a character that can, or James Bond, can sustain but with the Sainsbury twist, which if you read any of my books, I do like to kind of play with conventions a little bit. And it's doing that, but not going too far, I think is the trick. And when I look at World Walker and how well that did, I can see my instincts were very good there. With just taking things so far and not too far.
Keeping people within the framework. So your decision in the end was this thriller series. Now, as we're speaking now, it's not being released, so I can't look at it on Amazon, but I know we've had a conversation a few weeks ago about this, and you're close to the release point. So tell us about this series and what planning's gone into it.
Well, I was starting from... I think I've been waiting for the last couple of years for an idea for a character that would be able to do this, and there's no point in even getting started unless you've got the character has to come first with this, I think, for me. And I had an idea for a character, must have been February this year, I think. I did the thing that you shouldn't do, really. I'd got 39,000 words into a thriller with the working title of How to Train Your Assassin, which is actually could also be a series, a female protagonist, and it's a lot of fun and a really good idea. So I was just expecting to carry on and finish that. I don't abandon things halfway through. But then I got this idea and I couldn't go back to the other one. It was so insistent and such a strong idea, I thought. It's one of those ones when as soon as I had the idea, I thought, I want to read this. I want to read this character. I want to see this film. I want to see the TV series. You know, it felt that good. So I just abandoned briefly. I thought, I will go back to the other one. But I just started making notes and I thought, yeah, I've just got to write this. It was such a strong idea. I've got a lovely quote from Mark Dawson to stick on the top of the blurb, actually.
Excellent.
Because he's read an earlier draft of this. And it's, he says, Jekyll and Hyde meets Jack Reacher.
So you've got a psychological, a psychiatric issue with your protagonist. Well,
the protagonist is a very interesting character.
Okay.
Yeah. Tom Lewis, who's 32 years old, and he's built like Jack Reacher. He's a massive, massive guy, but naturally massive. But he suffered brain damage as a 12-year-old when he was shot in the head and left for dead, and his parents were murdered. And in fact, he was, to all intents and purposes, everyone thought he was dead because the people who shot his parents would have liked to have wiped out the whole family. So it was his death was announced. And we're now 20 years later and he can barely speak. He can't read or write. He works on a building site. But there's another side to Tom. And the people who murdered his family are getting picked off one by one.
Right.
So it's a nice, one hand, it's a nice straightforward revenge thriller, which I love a good revenge thriller. It has to be good. It has to grab me. But it's like that thing you're saying, you know where you are. You know, you think, oh, great. So people have done very bad things and we're going to see them get their comeuppance during the book. But the other side to this is the main character is, there are two sides to him. And we feel differently about the two sides. And as we get to know him, it's been out with beta readers. It's the advanced reader copies have come back. The comments are back and they're all saying the things that I hope they would say, which is that they want him to succeed. They love the Tom side of him and they feel almost maternal towards him and they're terrified of the other side.
Right.
but they're with him all the way. It's like you would be with Reacher, you know, or John Milton or James Bond. You want them to succeed.
And have you done, is there some medical research you've done in terms of schizophrenia, it's called, isn't it, the split personality? Or have you left this a little bit more fictional?
I've left it a little bit more open at the moment. I haven't gone too deeply into it. I have done research and it's not really schizophrenia, actually.
Okay.
And it's not multiple personalities. There's a new term for it medically, and I've I should have written that down.
Okay.
It's on one of my 300 tabs that are open in my research. there is a medical condition, but it's also, if you think of the original Jekyll and Hyde, there's he drinks a potion and he becomes, it's all his sort of worst quality. It's like the filter goes off, gets removed completely. And he goes back to like a savage almost. Well, right. This is a bit different. It's called Bedlam Boy, and that's what this character calls himself.
Okay.
And but he's the one who's got all the intelligence as well. You know, right. Tom.
It's a brookie.
Tom is the kind of guy who, he's lovely. People take advantage of him.
Yeah.
He moves snails off a path before walking up the front to the front of his house, so he won't accidentally step on them. That's the guy he is. But Bedlam Boy is if you think someone is going to take on a criminal organization and try and pick them off, they're going to need to be extremely intelligent as well as brutal and well-trained. He also disappeared for seven missing years in his background.
Okay.
But we know nothing about as readers. So
there's
exactly. And there's lots to come.
So you've got book one coming out, I think, on the 17th of July.
That's the plan at the moment.
Okay. All right. So the interview will probably go out after that point. So hopefully people, even if that plan's shifted a bit, will be able to find it.
Well, it'll be earlier if not. So
definitely be out. And in terms of marketing, so we in the little bit of time we've got left, Ian, let me just ask you how your marketing has evolved through that story. You started off doing the classic thing, and well done to you, uploading it and watching money coming in, which is fantastic. Doesn't happen to everyone. And at some point, have you started getting a handle on the ad side of things and list mailing lists and so on?
Yeah, more on the mailing list than the ad side. And my focus is now more on the mailing list, but you know, advertising is happening. This is something I've always struggled with. I love the writing process. I actually enjoy getting the covers together and writing the blurbs and all of that as well. But the marketing thing, my eyes glaze over, my brain starts to turn to mush, and it's not pretty. So I've got someone doing it for me at the moment, and we'll see how that goes. So that's the plan at the moment. But I have done some things differently this time, which hopefully will help with the sales. And I definitely want to build out the mailing list. I've written a reader magnet, which is, I'll write a short story about this character, and it'll be about 2,000 to 3,000 words. It ended up being over 8,000 words. And it's a great fun episode called the Las Vegas Driving Lesson. So I'm giving that away to my list this week. And in the back of each book, of course, will be a chance to sign up and get a copy of that. So I've done that right this time. It's all ready to go as the book comes out, instead of being an afterthought. And I've done something this is an experiment, and who knows how it'll go. But I saw the other thing that pushed me into writing this was what Dean Koontz did with Amazon Publishing in America at the end of last year, which was the Nameless series. Now, I like reading. I love short stories. I don't write short stories, and I like novellas, and I love episodic stories, which is more often on TV now. We all watch a lot of Netflix and Amazon Prime and HBO these days. So I like that we're going to tell a story, but we're going to tell it in 6 episodes. And that's what, with Nameless, Dean Koontz did. And it's been massively successful. And it's they're a quid each. And I think they're about 15,000 words average each episode. Now, as we know, a quid is no good, because you're really giving yourself a mountain to climb by having that 35% royalty rate. But I wrote 6 episodes. I wanted to write it like a TV series. I write visually anyway. I see it's like watching camera angles. That's how I write, and then inside the character's head. So I wrote the arc of a 6 episode. I want a whole story told, but then I wrote episodically. So we've got 6 episodes going through. And so that I can give myself a chance of making some money, I've packaged them into 3 novella length books. So it's 2 episodes in each book.
Right.
So
you can charge $2.99 at least to get the 70%.
Well, I was going to do $1.99 and $2.99.
Yeah.
Yeah. And £1.99 in UK, so that I can get the that's hit the 70% royalty rate. But still, duty, it's still divided into two parts in each book. So you still get your six episodes, but you're reading two at a time before the next one comes out.
Okay.
So it's an experiment.
Yeah.
So that's the minimum price I can charge and still get my 70%. And I know I can write many more like this as well. That's quite a lot
of planning involved in this in terms of the stories. This is not one where you can just play with and think, I think I might do this in book three. If you're going to do this, you've got to know what book three, four, five, and six have in them at the beginning.
Yeah. So it's very much, I'm calling it in my head. This is season one.
Okay.
So books, it's Bedlam Boy 1, Bedlam Boy 2, Bedlam Boy 3. And the covers, instead of having the subtitles on the covers, that's what I've gone for. So it's very simple when you see it. And the colours will show you this is a complete story told across these six episodes. And so when 4, 5, and 6 come out, in my head, that's season two. And I might even say season two of Bedlam Boy, you know, where I think he'll be going to America.
Okay.
I have a few pages of ideas for this already, but again, episodic nature. So it'll be six episodes telling one story, but like a TV series where each episode has its own pace, has its own arc, but drives you forward into the other episodes. So they're not standalone episodes. You won't read one and think, I'm done with this now. They are propelling you through the first six episodes.
And there is a small danger there that some people do react badly to getting to the end of a book and realize they've got to buy the next book. I don't really understand that, because it's like a great thing to, you know, you wouldn't say that about a TV series, even if you buy the episodes individually on Amazon. But you will get maybe some disgruntled readers, you think?
Yeah, and I'm quite thin-skinned. I always get over it. It's fine, but you know, there will be some pacing up now and some swearing. And
well, that's okay.
It's a weird thing, because I like reading very long books and I like reading very short books and everything in between. And the only grounds I could think of for anyone being disgruntled would be as if they feel they've been misled in any way. And I'm being very careful and to make it clear. I've the word novellas there, short punchy reads, you know, doing everything I can to let people know what this is. It's, and in terms of the work I've put in, more work has gone into these three books and has gone into any of the novels because of that, the way the stories have been written. And
how many words are they?
They're between about 25 to 30,000 per novella. So,
okay.
But that's two episodes.
So it's about 50,000 plus words for $2.99 each time.
So around 30,000 for $2.99.
Oh, sorry. So about 15 per episode.
Yeah, about,
yes.
Average 15 per episode.
I'm with you. Yeah.
So okay. Slightly under. And it's, I mean, I think the final one is slightly shorter than that, just because it's accelerating towards the satisfying end. But of course you get the 8,000 word story for free,
and there you go. Yeah, to get you going
on top of that,
the Las Vegas driving lesson.
I feel like Amazon are I don't think Amazon, it's hard to know because it's such an opaque sort of company in many ways, but they, when they do something new and they keep, and they do innovate, and the Dean Koontz Nameless series is an example of that, but it's not the first time they've tried it. And there's a whole short read section to Amazon, which is very busy now, and is definitely getting livelier all the time. So I think that they've seen something. You know,
yes.
They're trying to get more books into this. They're trying to promote this shorter read idea. And I know as a reader, if I'm reading something, which I can't believe I'm saying this, but I will read on my phone now.
Mm.
I will be somewhere where I haven't got the Kindle. Or the iPad or whatever, and I'll read on my phone.
I do the same, although I like you, I hate it.
Yeah.
I'm not comfortable with it, but I much prefer having the Kindle. Do you go into KU? Will you go into KU with these?
I always have.
Yeah.
With every book, and I've done well in KU.
Yeah.
But so yes, I'm certainly planning on it for this, and I'm just going to see how it goes. I'm certainly open to the idea of going wide if it's the right thing to do. And this is something new, so I'll see. I'll try and be led by sales and by what people are telling me. And
yeah,
I suppose this
will be slightly tougher in KU because of the page length. You know, the word count over the whole series. If I've got this right, is about 90,000 to 100,000 words across the whole series.
Yeah, so it's about I think it's about 85 over the first three books. So it's like a full length novel.
So
over the trilogy.
Yes. Yeah. So you've got basically, you could, you know, in terms of KU reads, it won't really matter how you've done it up. People, you're being paid by the page.
Well, that's, yeah. And that's another thing that I think with the pricing model is that if you're in KU,
it
makes no difference.
Doesn't matter.
You just get a couple of extra pretty covers to look at. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Oh, well, Ian, it's really interesting talking to you. We have to follow this up because I think a lot of people will be intrigued by the approach to the sort of shorter episodic. It seems very zeitgeist, as you say. Everyone's sort of consuming TV like this all the time at the moment. And there's been a huge amount of very successful novel adaptations. I'm thinking of the Big Little Lies turned into these episodic format, and it works brilliantly. I mean, that was a fantastic series. We're watching Little Fires Everywhere now, which is a very similar thing. So it seems very zeitgeist to me, this approach.
Yeah. I'm not sure if I like being zeitgeist or not, James. All I can say is it's really good, really good fun to write that way. And it's different, and it feels like a mixture between, I mean, I have written scripts. You know, I've been in BBC meetings before where something's gone on got to a certain level where you get invited in and talk through scripts. I've even had a read through of a pilot episode or something. So I've been on that side of the fence, and I enjoy writing fiction on the page far more than scripts, far more.
Yeah.
But this way, that side of pacing it that way has been such fun to do and really engaging. And I think that comes through in the writing. So, well, yeah. Yeah, follow it up. Let's see. I'll be here with the beard. I'll be back, and there'll be a bottle of vodka next.
Looking slightly older.
Yeah, a lot older.
Or you'll be in this Armani suit, saying, "I haven't got time to talk to you, Blatch."
Well, that's how I started this interview, of course. But, yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, Ian, look, really lovely to catch up with you. Congratulations again on the win, and just, you know, fingers crossed and best wishes with this series. I have a feeling it's going to do well, but we'll see.
We'll see. Thanks, James.
This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
So that's Ian Sainsbury. Great to have Ian on the show. We definitely wish him the very best of luck with that. We'll be watching it very carefully. We've had sort of a commercial chat with Ian as well in the background about some of this as well, so we'll be very interested in how that works out for him. I would say, I mean, one of the reasons I love reading novels, and funny enough, we've been throwing out books recently, and I came across some books I read in the 1980s when I was a kid, and I did love those big doorstep books. I read those big, very thick books. And you feel like you've lived a bit of a life in a big, long novel where lots happen. And that's what I love. I love feeling a bit bereft after I've finished a big novel. And I worry that in 20 to 30,000 words that you can't get that level of depth. You can't produce that kind of life-changing feel, or at least the characters in the book whose lives have changed. Can you do that, do you think, in that time? That
word they're different experiences, aren't they? So, you know, it's a shorter novella is more like a snack, really, I guess, but it doesn't have to be a snack that isn't nutritious, you know. And anyway, it can just be something that you enjoy, pick up and enjoy, put down again, forget about. There's nothing wrong with that at all. With the kind of thicker novels, and I know, you know, I've got a few of those that I remember quite fondly as well. You get much, the canvas is much broader, and you get to do a lot more in terms of characterization and perhaps chronology and all of that kind of stuff. It's, you have more scope to play around with things that you wouldn't have with the short fiction. But, you know, I don't think they need to be, neither is necessarily better than the other. They offer different different things to different readers at different times. And I think there's enough room in the market for all kinds of fiction, which, you know, with your 350,000 word.
Yeah, well, you can see why I want people's lives to change. Good. Okay, well, let's not move on to that subject. I've even got a temperature warning on my camera with my air conditioning on. That's what's happening in the UK today. Everything melts.
It's hot.
Good. Okay, look, thank you very much indeed to our guest, Ian. Lovely to have you on. I did trail ahead the Marie Force interview. That is going to come, I think, probably in September. I'm waiting for... She's got a bit of a... she did tell me after the interview she has a bit of a public milestone coming up in the next few weeks. So I think we'll try and coincide it with that. Good. That's it. You can go and enjoy the sunshine now, Mark. Got big plans for the weekend?
There's barbecue tonight, so I'm going to be going to Marks and Spencer's to buy some salad. That's how exciting my life is this afternoon. And then I'll be burning everything this evening. Yeah. And the pool might be open. I think there'll be some pool action this evening.
Yeah.
It's quite nice, as it's nice now. And I think the forecast is very nice for the next few days. So we're going to be enjoying our brief English summer before it gets grim again in a week's time.
Yeah. Yeah, that is the downside of this. We do love our warm days, but they are not guaranteed in this country. You are not just going to have salad in your barbecue. You're going to have copious amounts of meat, I assume.
There may be some meat, yes.
Okay.
Apologies to vegans and vegetarians out there. There might be a little bit of meat. It's entirely possible.
No animals were harmed. Well, apart from all the animals that are harmed for the barbecue. Good. Okay, thank you very much indeed. All that leaves me to say is that it's a goodbye from him.
And a goodbye from me. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Get show notes, the podcast archive, and free resources to boost your writing career at selfpublishingshow.com. Join our thriving Facebook group at selfpublishingshow.com/Facebook. Support the show at patreon.com/selfpublishingshow. And join us next week for more help and inspiration so that you can make your mark as a successful indie author. Publishing is changing, so get your words into the world and join the revolution with the Self-Publishing Show.